Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
So first up, we'll take a look at the business stories that are making this morning's papers and indeed online. Delighted to be joined this morning by Bob Hoffman of Vista Executive Search, and also by Susan Hayes-Culleton of Hayes-Culleton, and also the Positive Economist. You're both very welcome to the programme. Bob, you're looking very dapper this morning, so thanks for putting on a tie.
Thank you,
for coming
Bobby.
In to see us.
Nobody wears them anymore.
We're impressed with you, with your attire. So, Susan, we're going to start with you because I know you're a dye-in-the-wool GAA fan, and it's the front page of today's Irish Independent. And I really do want your reaction to this because the GAA are seeking a showdown as Harris ignites new row over pay-per-view. What is going on in the GAA?
Okay, so first of all, there's a big match happening this evening in Páirc Uí Chaoimh. I am going, and it is between Cork and Limerick. And myself and my brother were talking about going to this match Christmas morning, would you believe? This has been in the diary now for quite some time.
This is a big game.
It's a very big game. Obviously, Cork's fortunes haven't been wonderful against Waterford and against Clare. So, and this is a really big match. First of all, it's a big, two big counties, obviously, in Munster. And nobody needs reminding of who Limerick are and particularly their track record. However, big match, 45,000 people this evening in Páirc Uí Chaoimh. But the issue here is that if you're not going into Páirc Uí Chaoimh this evening at 7 o'clock, then, of course, the only way to see the match
you're in for €12.
I looked at that. So, yeah, if you buy it on a one-off basis, it's €12. But I just looked up at the prices for GAA Go. And you get three for the price of two for €24, and a season pass is €79. So the €12 figure is if you're only watching this match. So let's just get the full...
I think it's important to put that in context.
Full facts out there. So over the weekend, 20 games are going to be played at an inter-county basis and five will be streamed, either between RTE or GAA Go. Here's the issue, is that this is the big one. It is the big one. And this is the one where one would argue that if the GAA was only... and listening to its grassroots, is that this is the one that would be shown on television as opposed to putting it behind a paywall, because there is a cost involved, and particularly for people who do have a really big interest, there is a cost then involved in something that is to a large degree of community and cultural interest around the country.
Why is this causing so much anger?
I think because over the years, I mean, any of us that have been watching the Sunday game over the years, we've always gone onto the television. We never thought anything about watching a match. Now, I know GAA Go obviously streams this to people who are going internationally, so they don't just have to go to an Irish bar in New York to look at a match, for example. But it's causing anger because it's putting a cost in front of something that people feel very, very passionate about. As people know, the GAA is the largest volunteer organisation in the country, and it absolutely taps into the hearts and minds and legacy. And when you ask people where they're from, if they have an interest in GAA, it goes back to where they're actually born, as in my good self, as opposed to where they're living.
Now, Bob, it's been very heavy on GAA. I know you're more a rugby man, but your own thoughts on this?
Well,
if we pay for, you know, premierships, we pay, like, it's a commercial model that, you know, that maybe so, and maybe just because that it's, there's some kind of selection process that you have to choose one game over the other is another reason that, you know, there seems to be a flawed kind of logic around which games are selected.
But it's a perfect opportunity for the GAA to learn from the mistakes of rugby and football. So let's face it, the Premiership in England started this whole craze, and we now have a situation where you have the average player who earns more in a week than the Taoiseach of Ireland does in a year. It's gone ridiculous, and rugby's slipping that way too. And GAA has the perfect opportunity to actually buck the trend and stick with the grassroots community. I might also add, for people in the media, this is why dodgy boxes have surged. Because at one point you needed to sign up to about four or five different services just to see your favourite sport. I think the GAA should be brave and stick to the culture that is unique and do no pay-per-view.
That same Taoiseach, by the way, is coming to Cork this evening, so I look forward to having a chat with him about said matter.
Yeah. Okay, we'll leave it there before there's a complete row here. secondly then, let's look at the housing market, Susan. Some interesting reports out from Cairn Homes. Michael Stanley, the main man there, saying that the state has enough construction workers to build 50,000 homes a year. We're also seeing that their own output in Cairns is expected to rise by 30% per year. So what's the problem?
What I find really interesting about this piece that Owen Burke Kennedy wrote is that the statement that Michael said yesterday in the AGM is that we have an abundance of labour in residential construction, despite what people may say. That to me is a real standout here, because that certainly goes against the
narrative.
It is, but he says that this is reallocating the construction workers who were involved, particularly in office block building, as a result of, as we know, a decline in the number of people physically going to work. So I think that's a very interesting point. But also, I did take a look at the planning permission that was granted in the past while, because he said that it is the lack of serviceable land is the real challenge holding back building in this country, as distinct to other things. And 64% of all apartment units granted for use in 2023 were in Dublin, but multi-development house units granted permission in 2023 were up 40%. And I think that's also an interesting point, is that we are seeing an acceleration of that happening. But what I think is another very important point here is that he said, and obviously in light of we're coming up to, I know it's a local and European election, but politics is at the top of the agenda at the moment, is that he said the state supports to aid buyers, he said, could, if they were withdrawn, would we see the same momentum in terms of supply in the housing market? And he said, absolutely not. He also then talked about the more favourable mortgage market and the limited supply of competitively priced starter homes were also driving a positive momentum. And one of the points that stood out to me here is when you look at their operating profit, it's not just that their output is up by 30%, but they're set to make an extra 30 million in terms of their operating profit as well. So all of this just points out to the momentum that is happening. And one last point I will mention is Cliff Taylor had a very interesting piece in the Irish Times yesterday, which said 8.3 billion of state resources are going into housing at this point. Now, when you compare that to the 10.9 billion that's in education, there's a phenomenal amount of money being put into housing now. And so the conversation around there isn't enough money being put in here, I think we now need to start being critically analytical of whether it's making a difference to people in terms of the cost and availability of what they really need.
Okay, well said, Susan. Bob, he's also saying that again, that they're dealing with an ageing workforce in construction, which I thought was an interesting point.
I was just about to jump on that. Yeah. There's two side issues to what Susan has said. One, by the way, is we don't have enough planners. So planning is a big problem with housing. But the second one is, he was asked, do I think that the construction labour market is healthy on a 10 to 20 year view? No, it's an ageing workforce. I was at the LinkedIn EMEA conference there, first one in 5 years in Dublin, and they said this amazing statistic. Out of the generation X, Y and Z and millennials, there's only one segment of the market, of the talent market, that's growing. Gentlemen and ladies, it's the over 55s.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, our birth
rate... So why wouldn't it be? Yeah.
Our birth rate's dropping and everybody's living longer. So in the trade world, everybody's getting older and you can't climb ladders and lift heavy equipment if you're 55, 65. So there's the issue.
Yeah, and also the number of young people coming into the business or into the trades is another issue.
Apprenticeships. They should really push apprenticeships.
Susan, some economics here on the basis of savings accounts and interest rates and all that stuff that we read about. But I'm staggered to see Charlie Weston's piece today telling us that savers warn to lock in before banks start cutting deposit rates. They never even put them up. Exactly. And now they're cutting them.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is, I think, a misnomer, Bobby. And the reason that I say this is that what is shocking me about this is that recent figures show that bank deposits by Irish households are now at a record 153.6 billion in February. Right? That's not the shocking bit. The shocking bit is that 90% of Irish households remain in accounts paying little in interest when there have been an awful lot better ones available. And they have been put up, but I think the banking sector has been shocked at just
Just drive into that for a second. So 90% of Irish household deposits remain in accounts paying little interest. So one of the reasons for that is that people are fearful of banks, or are fearful of banks they don't know, or there's some hesitancy to move away from the banks that they grew up with, or there's a little bit of psychology in it, I would suggest. There might be laziness.
It's apathy. I think it's consumer apathy,
Excuse me, we invented procrastination as a nation. So I think it is a huge risk. I'm about to move my rapidly dwindling estate, as I tell my two children, to my N26 card that's paying 4% from my Irish institution that has been paying me 0.25.
Well,
you're happy to do that, Bob?
The German government, I underpin it for 100,000.
Well, yeah. But there's higher rates available at the moment of 3% and above from AIB, Bank of Ireland, Trade Republic, Raisin, N26 and Bunk. Charlie Weston mentions this, but I would say to anybody who is sitting at home today and listening to the three of us and saying, oh sugar, I really need to go and do something about that, go to ccpc.ie. It's the Consumer and Competition Protectorate. And look there, they have got a state-backed, fully impartial, objective money calculator and competition competition tool.
So it's an analysis website of a comparative site of who's offering the best where.
Exactly. And yeah, it is totally free and your taxes have paid for putting it there. So go and have a look there and you'll see the best rates available.
Okay. Bob, electric cars, they're still in the news. Maybe not all for good reasons, because there's maybe more bad news in terms of the stats today. We're being told in the Irish Independent that the sales of electric cars slump further as motorists turn back to diesel and petrol.
So this is an article by Adrian Rettler, and we've all been reading the media over the last few months about this. And the gist of it is that the run rate for electric vehicles has dropped 16% since the start of the year. But pardon the pun, it accelerated to a 38% drop in April. And that is with a backdrop that overall new cars are up 10%. So the market is growing and electric is dropping. And why? The main reason is chronic depreciation. Most people don't realise it's not your fuel, it's not your servicing, your NCT, your insurance. It is depreciation. It is by far the biggest cost. And some electric drivers have had 50% depreciation. I'm sure Susan will agree with this. The depreciation curve is the perfect time to buy a car as a three-year-old car and sell it at six.
Well, that's what I was just going to say, that if you wanted to come into the market now, because the first guy has taken most of the depreciation, you could get real value buying a three-year-old car.
I think that what characterises this conversation in 2024 is the actual presence of the second-hand market, because that hasn't been there all along. The big issue here is infrastructure. Again, since you all know where I'm going this afternoon, I mean, driving from Dublin to Cork, and if you have got an EV where, let's say the range is less than 100, or let's say it's between 100 and 300 kilometres, you'll be getting kind of nervous by the time you hit Dunkettle, I can tell you. And this is the issue, is that we don't have the infrastructure. And I think that there's a point here that Adrian makes about the government has a target of making 30% of Ireland's privately owned cars electric by 2030, a goal of around 700,000 vehicles that seems highly unlikely, and it would require sales of electric cars to more than quadruple over the next six years.
6 years, yeah.
Next
so
six,
that's
six years.
Four times in 6 years, which ain't going
to
happen.
I can't see that happening. I think the merit is good. I know Boris Johnson obviously tried to have the same target, the same issue was happening there, but it is the infrastructure, it's the depreciation. But the other thing is that if we were to look into the future, plus one would argue then is that if we're all going to be pushing a button and getting into autonomous vehicles in, I'm going to say, 15 years time, we could. So therefore the question then becomes, are we investing in infrastructure that could be irrelevant in time to come?
Just on the depreciation, so 30 to 50% depreciation in electric vehicles. I drive a 2 litre diesel. It gets me 60 miles to a gallon. After 4 years, I've done 100,000 kilometres, and guess what? It is more or less the same value as when I bought it, according to the car's own website. And yet electric owners are just losing their...
But how much have you spent then, though, Bob, on having that car instead of charging it up electrically and using a lot less money to keep it the show on the road?
But the range anxiety... I'm saying electric is the future, but you mentioned about the infrastructure, which, by the way, I solved in this very show. Do you remember my suggestion of every street light in the country, just install a plug?
And the company doing that withdrew from the marketplace. Yeah, there you go. So... What about the plan for Dublin's tallest building being rejected by the planners? An article in today's Irish Times by Ronald Quinlan. The developer behind a bid to build Dublin's tallest building, 24 stories, on the site of the former City Arts Centre at City Quay. And this is a site that's been idle for a number of years.
I mean, the fact it's been dormant for 20 years. I used to go for lunch in that little arts cafe, but let's be honest, it was a very run-down section of the quays. It's been dormant for 20 years, and I alluded to it earlier on. The planners, Simon Harris is my local TD, and I sent him an email the night before he became Taoiseach with a few suggestions. Whether he takes them or
as
not
you
is
would,
up
Bob.
To him. But my number one thing is Bord Pleanála and the planning process in this country is a broken model. The dogs in the streets know this. So I don't know if this was the right building or the right height, but the point is they're 2 years trying to get this through. And the inspector, by the way, actually approved it. And then Bord Pleanála rejected it. We need to build things. We can't have situations.
Yeah, I don't know where it goes next. But does that mean that they end up building something that's 18 stories or 15 or...
Yeah, and in the meantime, years have passed. And I mean, look, Conor McGregor had an apartment complex in the city also rejected this week. You know, you can't keep rejecting every single thing that comes up. It goes back to procrastination.
Personally, I'm comfortable with an area like the Docklands down by the river, down that can be built up into the sky. I think it's if that's the trade-off with people moving to Carlow and Portlaoise and all the rest of it, I think it's I think if it's good design, we shouldn't be afraid of it.
And picking up on the good design, it's also like 1,400 square metres of artist studios and exhibition space distributed across the front of the building. If you look at the purpose of the building as well, like where does that go? Personally, I would be in favour of it as well. And also its neighbour, of course, is the IFSC, that is no stranger to height. I think Dublin needs to go up. Personally, I would be in support of that as well. But I do wonder where those artists are going to go now.
And by the way, we've Liberty Hall across the road for 40 years.
Which was 13 stories.
13.
Something like that.
There's a precedent for tall buildings in this part of the city.
Yeah. I was much closer to this at one time than I am now, but I'm still interested in the piece. Cocoa rally is spilling into coffee as traders run out of cash. Cocoa is much more challenging in the long term than coffee. And this interesting piece here in the Irish Examiner, basically linking the increase in coffee prices now to the basically historical increase in cocoa, which went through the roof in the last 12 months, because a lot of the end users are the same. I thought that was a kind of a weird reason why it was like a kind of a contamination, because the customer base was the same that they would be impacted.
And
It seemed odd, rather than it being a supply origin.
I think that also the fact that the supply is very concentrated in certain environments like coffee, the concentration I saw here, Vietnam and Brazil account for more than half of global coffee bean exports.
And you know, Vietnam is a relatively new country in coffee.
Mm. And they have
They went from zero to a huge percentage in 20 years.
And if any of you have had a Vietnamese coffee, you know you wouldn't want to be going to sleep too soon after it either. It is very strong.
It kicked like a mule.
It's lovely, but strong. But also there is a... So the issue here is that we're dealing with extreme short weather, which is leading to shortages. Since there's concentration in Vietnam and Brazil in coffee and cocoa in West Africa, all of this then has led to the fact that the supply has been constricted. But then, of course, the fact that this that Elena Peng and Diane Sousa talk about the traders running out of cash, people might be wondering, what exactly has that got to do with anything? At the end of the day, that there's traders in commodity markets, in stock markets around the world, and where they are bidding up and down the price as well. Since there is a huge amount of leverage that can often be on this, when you have got a volatility in the market, it can then lead to really big, significant trades being led by margin calls. And then that means that people don't have the money to handle the volatility and then they have to leave. Then that triggers extra volatility. And then at the end of the day, this is going to affect the price of coffee and cocoa in one's pocket. But I thought what was very interesting is at the end of this piece, it talks about Europe imports 60% of cocoa beans and accounts for 75% of global chocolate sales.
I know you like a bar of chocolate, Bob, but your European colleagues, we definitely do punch above our weight.
Absolutely.
In terms of chocolate consumption.
By the way, of course, like with everything, there's winners and losers. And of course, the winner here could be the tea industry. And if I was in the tea industry, I'd be going on the offensive and taking on the coffee moguls. Sorry, Bobby.
And when I think of like the most beautiful chocolate in the world, I think of Belgium, I think of Switzerland. And of course, I did actually think, well, where else outside of Europe would you go to for your high-end chocolate? So this is one to watch. And as somebody that loves coffee even more than chocolate, I hope, lads, you calm down.
Watch this space. Back to technology, Bob. Adrian Weckler telling us today that why it's not just Generation Z who are hung up about answering the phone. I'm kind of puzzled by this one, because I think if somebody rings you, it's the most direct, you know, want to talk to you now, this is what I have to say, uncomplicated way of getting your message across. But what he's telling us is that that the time spent on phone calls in the Irish telecoms market has gone down by 30%.
Yeah, it's a very interesting article. And I was involved in telecoms in 1997. I sold the first ever smartphone in Ireland. So, and I do remember when it was 98% voice and 2% text. And I remember our boss, the legendary Jerry McQuaid, called us in and said, guys, we need to get data up to 4%. We have a new product. He called it the Blueberry for a while until we corrected him, the Blackberry. But we thought he'd lost the plot. And of course, now data is about 80, 90% and voice is the other. But you switch the comparison company who came up with this survey basically said as Gen Z and the younger millennials prefer low pressure voice notes and of course WhatsApps and texts. So this is a psychological thing. And I think, you know, as David McWilliams always says, economics is all about, you know, emotions and people's thoughts. This is people feel pressurized taking phone calls. Now, we're of an older generation. You want to get something done and fixed and sorted, you phone somebody. It's so much more productive. But the trend is that people prefer to let it go to the voicemail and then switch over to some sort of messaging service. So it's the sign of the times. Nobody talks anymore. Except us.
Yeah, I suppose where I come from on this perspective is I'm very grateful to say I've a very busy day, usually every day. And I am one of these people that probably does let the phone call ring out and I will, but I don't text them back. I will call them back. All right. Just because I am, as he describes here, generally in the middle of something when somebody does ring. So it's not because I feel pressured into answering or anything else. It's usually because I've every minute of the day scheduled and it can be an interruption, I suppose you might call it that way, but I certainly don't see it any other way. I do think that a complete aversion to speaking on the phone is different. I have no aversion whatsoever to speaking on the phone.
Okay.
And I think that that's where this might be coming from.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to my guests, Bob Hoffman and Susan Hayes Cullett, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Enjoy the sunshine and a lovely weekend.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.